Part of the problem has been a lack of competition from the private sector due to the walled gardens incumbent banks have built. High barriers to entry stem from high fixed costs, complex regulatory requirements, lack of interoperability in data standards, outdated legacy platforms, and the economic scale required to perform sufficient liquidity and risk management to facilitate global payments. All of these reasons make it difficult for new entrants to innovate in this industry. Despite all of these constraints, the free market finally provided the competition these incumbent banks so desperately needed. Bitcoin and the Lightning Network have arrived to show the world that we finally have the technology available to bring cheap global payments to everyone in the world. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. What a wonderful day of sweet, ripe red candles to be stacking sats on, to be picking up Bitcoin behind the bloodbath of the leverage traders and the Terra USD and all the crap. fun day in Bitcoin. I hope you guys listened to my PSA. Couple of little lessons there for times like these. It gets a little bit crazy, but we are back to Signal. We have got a great one today. This is on the Swan Bitcoin blog, and this one is written by Sam Callahan, who is awesome, by the way. You should be following him. I will have the link in the show notes to the article, and as well as, you know, to Swan Bitcoin if you want to sign up and you haven't. What are you doing? You know, Swan Bitcoin is the best place, auto stack. And also to reiterate the PSA from earlier, get your funds off of exchanges. And that includes Swan Bitcoin. Swan Bitcoin goes out of their way to make it so that you can withdraw. They will do it for you to your keys, but also get yourself a hardware wallet, get yourself a BitBox, and make sure you are holding your own keys, because some of these other shitcoin exchanges rehypothecate. Some of them are exposed to some of this stablecoin crap. You do not want to be the one holding the bag. So withdraw, keep your shit safe, and a thank you to our sponsors for being a part of that little puzzle to make sure those things can happen. And also a shout out to Fold. It looks like they are going to be sponsoring with us again, so we will have Fold back. I'm a huge user of Fold. I've still kind of been shilling them on the show quite a bit, even though they haven't been paying me. And now's a fresh time to start running shit through the Fold card, because you get way more sats when the price is down. But anyway, I got sidetracked. Let's just go ahead and get into the article for today. This is about the Lightning Network. This is about the global payments infrastructure and what is wrong with it, both in the way it simply operates, but more importantly, inherently, what is wrong with it that it can't even be avoided, and how that new system, that superior system, is here. It is Bitcoin and Lightning, and we're going to get all into it, thanks to Sam Callahan. So without further ado, let's jump in to today's article, and it's titled, Running the Numbers, Riding the Lightning Network, Cheap Global Payments for All, by Sam Callahan. For many years, a prime focus of organizations such as the Bank of International Settlements, the IMF, and the World Bank has been making retail cross-border payments, including remittance payments, cheaper and faster for end users. Yet, despite the international community's efforts, cross-border payments continue to be plagued with issues, including high fees, slow settlement times, poor transparency, and limited access. Technology has advanced at an exponential rate with the growth of the internet. Domestic payments have benefited from this progress in the form of improved efficiency and lower costs, but international payments have not seen the same improvements. The world is connected technologically, but not financially. Despite these technological advances, it can still take as long as 10 days to transfer money to different jurisdictions, and that transaction can come with costs as high as 15% in some countries. Believe it or not, cross-border payment systems today still use message formats developed nearly 50 years ago for the SWIFT network, an interbank messaging system. Part of the problem has been a lack of competition from the private sector, due to the walled gardens incumbent banks have built. High barriers to entry stem from high fixed costs, complex regulatory requirements, lack of interoperability and data standards, outdated legacy platforms, and the economic scale required to perform sufficient liquidity and risk management to facilitate global payments. All of these reasons make it difficult for new entrants to innovate in this industry. Despite all of these constraints, the free market finally provided the competition these incumbent banks so desperately needed. Bitcoin and the Lightning Network have arrived to show the world that we finally have the technology available to bring cheap, global payments to everyone in the world. The problems. 1. High costs. Quote, "Among the long-standing issues, it is striking that in spite of technological progress and the decline in information processing costs, digital payments have remained stubbornly expensive." Hyun-Song Shin, head of research at the BIS. To understand why cross-border payments still cost so much, we need to better understand today's system. I mentioned the SWIFT messaging network above, which allows banks from different jurisdictions to communicate with one another in a standardized manner. But banks don't actually send funds through the SWIFT network. They use something called the Correspondent Bank Network, or CBN, for that task. Correspondent banks are a network of intermediary banks that connect disconnected financial institutions in order to settle funds between jurisdictions. Transactions can involve multiple stops at these intermediaries, increasing costs and delays. The friction associated with this model involves differing regulatory risks in each jurisdiction, compliance costs, foreign currency exchange costs, and the risk of loss of funds or fraud. Depending on the jurisdiction, sometimes one single cross-border payment can involve several correspondent banks and multiple currency exchanges, each one with its own fees for processing and foreign exchange until the payment finally settles at its intended destination. The average cost of sending a cross-border payment through the CBN is about 10%. These fees are from SWIFT messaging fees, transaction fees, and foreign currency exchange fees. These fees add up with each intermediary that's used and average out to around $25 to $35 of fees per $200 transaction. The smaller and more secluded the jurisdiction is, the more expensive the payment is. In 2022, 96% of the estimated $156 trillion in cross-border payments will be done between banks using the CBN explained above. But what about the individual or small businesses that need to send smaller amounts of money internally? This smaller cohort typically sends international micropayments using traditional money transfer operators, or MTOs, such as Western Union, TransferWise, and MoneyGram. These MTOs are financial companies that facilitate cross-border payments for consumers using their own internal systems or other alternative cross-border banking networks. Below is a good graphic that displays the cross-border payment structure used by different user types today. Compared to the CBN used to facilitate bank-to-bank payments, MTOs are not much better in terms of cost for end users. According to the World Bank's most recent data, the global average remittance payment cost per transaction for MTOs was recorded at 6.57% in quarter two of 2021. Said differently, if an individual wants to send a $200 cross-border payment to their family back home, the family will only receive $186.86 after fees. This may not seem like a large difference to you, but these costs can greatly impact a family's living standards and quality of life in a poor developing nation. Keep in mind, that's only the average cost as well. The MTO costs vary widely across different jurisdictions. In more remote, less developed jurisdictions, the cost to send a cross-border payment can be greater than 10%. These costs remain well above the UN's target goal of 3% by 2030. The high costs associated with cross-border payments in our traditional financial system are simply unacceptable, given the technological capabilities we have at our disposal today, and disproportionately affect individuals transacting small dollar amounts in the poorest regions across the world. 2. Slow settlement times. One of the biggest challenges with cross-border payments is how long it takes for them to settle. An average international payment takes 2 to 3 days to clear, which stands in stark contrast to domestic payments, which typically show up in one's bank account in mere seconds. In certain jurisdictions, these delays can even take as long as 10 business days, depending on the number of intermediaries involved to process the transaction. These long delays are caused by many factors, including incompatible data formats between correspondent banks, complex compliance checks, limited operating hours across multiple time zones, and long transaction chains involving multiple intermediaries. To fix this issue, SWIFT has been working on a new system called SWIFT Global Payment Initiative, or GPI, that works to reduce the settlement times of international payments and allow banks and users to track payments on the SWIFT GPI's cloud solution. Below is the median end-to-end processing time for each beneficiary region using the SWIFT GPI. The average payment processing time was 8 hours and 36 minutes, or one business day, while the median time was 1 hour and 38 minutes. Although the processing time using the SWIFT GPI improved upon the 2 to 3 day average, after all of these years, it's underwhelming that an average of one business day is the best the international community can come up with in 2022. Also, the processing times differ drastically between jurisdictions and are noticeably worse in smaller emerging markets. Today, international payments still remain stubbornly slow, especially in emerging markets where many families depend on cash sent from family members working abroad for their livelihoods. 3. Lack of transparency and interoperability. Transparency, or lack thereof, is a big problem in cross-border payments today that adds friction and increases costs for users of all types. Cross-border payments remain unpredictable and opaque. Users are not made aware of where the payment is at any time, nor the fees accumulated throughout the process until the payment has settled. The complexity of the fees makes it very difficult for users to understand them. In a survey conducted by Capital Economics in 2021, 55% of American consumers said they understood the costs, but only about 20% of that same cohort correctly identified the costs. In another survey by Wise, they found 3 in 4 Singaporeans were unaware of hidden costs of cross-border payments, with 88% underestimating fees. Lack of transparency with fee structures is part of the issue, but another is the lack of transparency in tracking the funds between banks and other service providers. This difficulty in the tracking of funds is partly because many of these correspondent banks, MTOs, and fintech companies are not interoperable. In today's diverse financial ecosystem, customers cannot move funds between services because they are all using different data standards and communication tools. This incompatibility leads to more delays, increased compliance checks, and more fees. The opaque nature and lack of interoperability of the cross-border payments industry today lead to higher costs, slower processing times, and a worse experience for users and banks alike. 4. Lack of accessibility. Today, bank account penetration remains low, with an estimated 1.7 billion unbanked people worldwide. Many people do not have access to the correspondent banking network or money transfer operators used for cross-border payments, and these solutions are especially unavailable in developing nations. This is partly due to the steady decline in the number of correspondent banks over the past decade. Most banks can't afford the high fixed cost of facilitating cross-border payments and shut down, impacting accessibility for those who need it most. Today, this outdated cross-border payment system is simply not accessible to billions of people, especially in emerging markets. The solution is here. Quote, "There is no omnipresent system that connects various banks across the world through which international payments can be transacted." Mark Recker, Managing Director and Global Head of Product Institutional Cash Management at Deutsche Bank. I have some good news for you, Mark. The omnipresent system you dream of, it already exists. Bitcoin is an open monetary system that enables every bank and individual in the world to connect to one standardized protocol. It is a decentralized, digitally native monetary network that is globally accessible and allows people to reliably send and receive payments that settle with cash finality. It is a system that solves all the problems that have plagued cross-border payments for decades. It's completely transparent, has relatively low fees, every entity that uses it is interoperable with one another, and anyone with a mobile phone and internet connection can access this network. Unlike bank accounts, mobile phone penetration in developing nations has rapidly increased. According to Pew Research, over 83% of adults in emerging markets own a mobile phone. The alleged knock against Bitcoin is that the fees can be high, and it doesn't have the transaction speed capacity necessary for it to scale globally. However, Bitcoin is software, and solutions can be built on top of software. The Lightning Network is a second-layer payment protocol built on top of the Bitcoin network that optimizes for speed and cost. Theoretically, the Lightning Network can allow for millions of transactions per second that can settle at practically no cost. Below is a graphic that highlights how the Lightning Network improves Bitcoin's shortcomings regarding payments. The Lightning Network is a technology that allows individuals to send small, international payments without any bank intermediaries nearly instantly and essentially for free. It is a groundbreaking innovation in cross-border payments, and it's just beginning to be adopted. The rapid growth of the Lightning Network. This year, we have seen the Lightning Network explode in usage across the globe as people wake up to its advantages over the incumbent system. The total amount of Bitcoin currently deployed for transfers over the Lightning Network now stands at 3,702 BTC, or $139.55 million. That means that the total amount of liquidity on the Lightning Network has increased 208% over the last year alone. Furthermore, the total amount of Lightning nodes on the network has increased 93.84% over the last year to a total of 19,935 nodes online. As more and more nodes come online, the Lightning Network's efficiency improves, liquidity increases, and more products and services will be built on top of it. Usage is growing rapidly, made possible by a whole ecosystem of companies and projects. The significant adoption occurring on the Lightning Network is evidence of the vast improvements it offers users compared to all other options that exist today to send cross-border payments. A Lightning case study. We are already seeing how the Lightning Network is improving the lives of individuals in an emerging market today. El Salvador adopted Bitcoin as legal tender in September of 2021. El Salvador is heavily reliant on remittances. It received over $6 billion in remittances in 2020, or 23% of its GDP. According to an IMF report, it was estimated that the potential benefits of using the Bitcoin network for remittance payments could save El Salvadorians $54 million, or 0.25% of GDP per year. Also, the adoption of Bitcoin has already significantly increased financial inclusion by allowing more than 60% of the population to have access to the financial system in only 2 months. This occurred in only a few months of Bitcoin adoption, after decades of unsuccessful initiatives where previously only 23% of the population was banked. El Salvador is only months into adopting Bitcoin, but it is already providing El Salvadorans with more financial access and making it easier and cheaper to send funds outside their borders. It shows how this new system is already proving to be a massive improvement over the outdated legacy cross-border payment system. The cross-border payment industry has been ripe for disruption for many years, but high barriers to entry have prevented competition from entering the space. Bitcoin and the Lightning Network together will make cross-border payments faster, cheaper, more transparent, and more inclusive, which will have widespread benefits for increasing economic growth, international trade, and improving financial inclusion across the globe. The future of cross-border payments has arrived. All right, and that was Sam Callahan's piece on swanbitcoin.com, running the numbers, riding the Lightning Network. And I definitely have saved quite a few notes on this one, so we will talk about it in just a minute. Let's hit our sponsor really quick for today, and we'll jump back in. And who is that sponsor? Oh my God! No way, it's Swan Bitcoin. And you know, this is not why I chose to read an article in the Swan Bitcoin blog. It's just because they had a really great article in their blog. You know, Sam Callahan gets all the credit for this one. But Swan Bitcoin is, in fact, where you want to buy Bitcoin, where you set up your automatic savings, your automatic stack every month, every week, however you want to do it, and you set up with your automatic withdrawal so that in these uncertain times, you know that you have your Bitcoin behind your keys because it happens automatically after you set it up just once at Swan Bitcoin. And even better, for the high net worth individual seeking to take advantage of this rather beautiful buying opportunity, Swan Private has everything you need. It gives you direct access to the best team of Bitcoiners on either side of the Great Wall of China. They can walk you through just starting to get into Bitcoin, to understanding the basics, all the way to being a sovereign Bitcoiner, holding your own keys, using a hardware wallet. They'll work with your retirement accounts. There are no yearly limits on purchases. They've got support for business accounts, for trusts, for other entities. You know, Swan Private and Swan Bitcoin is just a no-brainer. Go to swanbitcoin.com/guy. That is my referral link. And you don't get discounts like this current price very often. If you have been waiting on the sidelines, that price is looking good. Check out swanbitcoin.com/guy for more info on the best way to get into Bitcoin. All right. So, this article, this one struck me just because I think this is a really good idea to refresh. It reminds me of a really great piece written by Galloway Money, who had been working with the Lightning Network for some years. In fact, I think I'm pretty sure Galloway is involved with the Bitcoin Beach Wallet, if I'm not mistaken. I'm pretty sure they develop it. Man, our global payments infrastructure is a mess. And I think people really forget that, you know, we talk about Bitcoin as money a lot, and that transition is going to take a while. And I've talked about more recently, and I want it to make sense in people's minds, that one of the most amazing things about Bitcoin and the Lightning Network is that it is a breakthrough open standards settlement system that has no borders. And that, just that element alone, is so, so difficult to overestimate. It will still take time to integrate this into all of our monetary and financial infrastructure. But when it does, this is going to get around so many problems that our global payment networks and our remittances and our cross-border payments literally cannot solve. It's not even a matter of, oh, they just don't have the right things or they're not properly interoperable. There are literally things that they cannot solve because of the nature of how the system actually works. And as I've said before, I think we're really moving into the phase of Bitcoin where Bitcoin grows from being a store of value and largely seen as an investment asset and into the medium of exchange era. And this will take a long time. Still, this transition will be rough, and it will have big swings up and big swings down. And I also think, importantly, it will probably have a lot of enemies, and it will also have a lot of opportunists, people who will be taking advantage of this because of the incredible amount of value that can be saved. But I've used the analogy numerous times before that one of the first major communication shifts that happened with the internet that most people weren't aware of is when the old communication lines, the old infrastructure that we used, switched over to a digital and an internet-based backend, much like the AT&T phone network. Like there were long distance fees. There were clear zones where you could and could not call. And as that infrastructure switched over, these things started to fall away. The, you know, where you would, you know, call from North Carolina or New York to California, when you call across the country, there would be this horrible hiss. You'd have this, you know, this feedback because you're going through so many different loops and different connections as you traveled through the analog network. That hiss started to fall away because you would connect to a local hub, it would switch to digital, it would shoot across the country, and then it would connect to another local hub, and you would start removing some of the major points of the analog system, but you're still using your corded phone. And then the same thing happened with long-distance fees. Long-distance fees started to fall away, and people just, it was just kind of like accepted that, oh, you just had this normal, cheap monthly fee for your phone, and you could just call anybody. But nobody knew why that transition occurred. It was because the internet communications infrastructure began to be used as a kind of as a medium of exchange for analog communications before everyone went natively digital and natively internet, which truly didn't happen. Like there was the desktop wave and the internet really exploded during the late 90s and early 2000s throughout there, but the move that truly happened, you know, looking back then, you would have said, oh man, the internet already occurred. In 2003, 2004, the internet is here. It took over everything. Holy shit, that was crazy. But you wouldn't have realized that the mobile revolution was about to 10x that. And it was truly after the iPhone, after the adoption and introduction of the smartphone, that everything changed. And that the explosion of the number of users on the internet and the fact that we get access to things through the internet first. Like if the internet had its store of value, medium of exchange, unit of account phase, it would have been the build out of the infrastructure and the protocols in the late 80s and early 90s until the web was truly born. And then the adoption started to really build out, and the medium of exchange phase happened where it became critical parts of the backend and infrastructure. And then we had the huge dot-com bubble and burst, which most people don't even know that even after the quote-unquote stock market, like the front facing of the web and the dot-com bubble exploded, there was actually a whole nother year almost of an infrastructure bubble that was happening, and that actually popped much later. But the really interesting thing about the infrastructure bubble, rather than as opposed to the dot-com bubble, is that the infrastructure doesn't go away. So when you build out all those lines and the the fiber connections and the coaxial, like the broadband, like that stuff doesn't go away even if the price adjusts and it gets resold and redirected towards a different purpose or for another company. Whereas the dot-com bubble was more of a pets.com was worth $100 million and then it was worth $20 the next day. So then the real infrastructure phase was probably, was really happened during the early 2000s, between 2002 and 2010, where it was so perfectly clear that even after the hype of the web died down and everybody was like, okay, the internet did its thing, it was fundamentally obvious to everyone who still had a brain left and was building anything out that the internet was the future of communications, and not just some communications, not just the web, not just desktop computers, all communication. All communication was going to happen over the internet, period. From top to bottom, the entire thing was going to be a digital packet switching infrastructure. And that is when, you know, it's like, what is it, like 2005, 2006, when Netflix was becoming big, and their whole intent, even when they were selling DVDs in mailboxes, like shipping people DVDs, they knew they were going to streaming. They were preparing for the infrastructure to get to that point. And that was when the major build out was truly occurring. And it wasn't until like 2008-ish, I think, up to 2010, really, that Netflix streaming just blew up, that it really started to happen, and the infrastructure matured enough that cable television started to look like they were going to be on the chopping block. And once the bandwidth hit that key turning point, and when the actual way to interact with the internet shifted into the hands of the consumer, shifted into a device that people were walking around with. And this is actually something that really got me from actually the conversation we had with Pascal from Ledger, the panel I did at Bitcoin 2022. In fact, I'll have a link to it if for anybody who hasn't seen it, if you want to watch it. But he has a really, really good point that I had never really articulated for myself, or I had never realized how strong the connection was. But he was absolutely right, was that the major revolutions of the internet truly occurred because of new hardware. It wasn't new software. The software may have still changed things. Like, the software may have still had huge impact, but it wasn't until there was a piece of hardware to truly utilize it, or there was a piece of hardware that made the software possible, that the next revolution was really kicked into gear. And that is so true of the mobile revolution. And I think that's an important thing to consider when we're looking at, like, what's the hardware, what's the device that is going to change the Bitcoin, it's going to move us into the next era of Bitcoin. But I believe, outside of the fact that I think there's going to be a whole nother Bitcoin wave and a monetary wave of the internet, and maybe we can extend this whole analogy out again in 20 years when we have hindsight and we're seeing really what changed as we've developed. But I would argue the unit of account phase, quote unquote, of the internet was the mobile revolution, when everyone truly, the first and default interaction of all communication was through the internet. And in that same way, I think we're witnessing this with money. I think Bitcoin has been a store of value. It has been building out its foundation. It has been growing with enough liquidity, you know, very metaphorically or analogous to the bandwidth necessary on the internet to even start talking about something like streaming Netflix, threatening the cable giants. And that's what we're talking about right now, that the liquidity on Bitcoin makes it such that you can actually use it to facilitate other payments. But the Lightning Network is the build out, I believe, of the web. It is that moment where the use of Bitcoin and the ability to facilitate essentially instant and damn near free payments that have no borders, that has no idea that there are jurisdictional or government or regulatory borders of any kind whatsoever. There are no barriers to entry. I am running my own little, in the context of a payments network on Lightning, I am running a little piece of the Visa network. I am running my own little corner of Lightning. I have my own channels. I can pay anybody. I am managing my own liquidity. There's zero barriers to entry outside of just knowing how to run the thing. And a quote from Sam in this article, it says, when he's referring to the legacy, legacy cross-border payments and international payment system, says, high barriers to entry stem from high fixed costs, complex regulatory requirements, lack of interoperability in data standards, outdated legacy platforms, and the economic scale required to perform sufficient liquidity and risk management to facilitate global payments. So I think it's really important to go over a handful of these things. One that I think is so important because each one of these institutions, because they're isolated networks, because they don't have a common language, is the lack of interoperability. Is that either the country is, you know, they're adopting their own standards within a country, or just because they speak a different language, or there's different development standards, because the bank is using their own internal structure, or they're running a payment network. Like, there are payment networks right now. Like, I think it's, what is it, Visa? I don't know, but there are literally payment networks that are running the same shit with the same code from the 70s. And I don't mean that like in the sense that they haven't updated the code, but I mean it in the sense that they're running a language, like an actual coding language that nobody knows, that there are so few developers for, and they're doing this on purpose. They specifically aren't updating it because they want that monopoly. They want to be able to increase the barriers so that people can't interoperate. I'm pretty sure it's the Galloway article that goes into that element of it specifically. And it had been something that like had been sitting in the back of my mind and I knew about, but I remember when they talked about it and I was like, oh my God, that's right. Like, and it just kind of refreshed it. Like these things, a lot of these institutions, because of the how the payment networks work because they're owned, much like the AT&T network and the phone network during analog days, the network was owned and you had to ask permission of for AT&T in order to get access or to have any communication network at all. Like, because they had the network, it's just like platforms. Like, you have to ask Apple to get on to get apps into the App Store and get all the access to the actual devices that you need to sell your product. Because of that, they have this ability to actually lock down their network and monetize their network effect rather than actually having a better service, rather than actually having a competitive advantage from the sense of the software or the product or the fees that they're offering. What they do is they simply control the network and that maintains their position. Payment networks are doing this like crazy because they are walled gardens, because they do not talk to each other, and some of them do not want to. They don't want this interoperability because that is how they achieve their dominance. That is how they make it so that small competitors can't compete with them, on top of the regulatory capture and increasing fixed costs in order to like basically shove any of their competitors out or pay off the right regulators to make sure that they don't get the proper licenses. So these things feedback on themselves. They get, you know, they hang on to that monopoly. They get to own that permission network. They get to make it non-interoperable, and they get to decide who uses their API and who doesn't, like who even has access to their network, which means that you just either do or do not have customers at Visa's request, period, which means you can't compete with them. You need them to even be a part of the ecosystem. Then that allows them outsized profits and revenue that they don't have to worry about ever losing because they own a permissioned network. And then they use that to buy the regulators to make sure that nobody can compete with them. And then you have this same dynamic across multiple countries because the jurisdictions draw strong lines in the banking and financial system of who can do what. and who's in charge and what the rules are. And if the rules aren't the same, well, then shit. You've got a problem on top of a problem on top of a problem. And every single layer of it is a new cost and a new risk in actually trying to be a part of the market. And worst of all, the entire system is just sending around liabilities. They're not actually moving money. They're moving promises of money, which means it can all be reversed. It is all at the potential irresponsibility of some institution somewhere in the mix. Somebody along the line could be rehypothecated or could just make an accounting error in their software and screw shit up just completely, and money could just disappear, which is why trying to update it to some newer standard and lower the cost is such a pain in the butt, because everybody has to be whitelisted. Everyone has to be vetted to be a part of it, because you're all exchanging liabilities. You're not moving actual value. You're moving something that is still someone else's responsibility to guarantee the value of. You can't fix that. You can't fix that within the system. It doesn't matter how many people you get on your standard or on the Swift GSI, I can't even remember the acronym, the global much better system, whatever the hell they called it. You're still moving a liability. You're still involving ownership of the actual network. You're still trying to force interoperability by making someone develop on your standard as opposed to theirs, which means you have the conflict of interest and the jurisdictions are inevitably going to bring those walls back up so that somebody can maintain dominance over their own internal market. And then the last thing in this quote says, which stood out to me, and I had to stop and I pause and think about it, which is so cool. The economic scale required to perform sufficient liquidity and risk management to facilitate global payments. Think about that. So with all the risk, with all the licenses, with all the jurisdictional arbitrage or costs involved, with the size you need to be to have access to and actually get customers to make sense as part of the network, with the permissions and the interoperability with the dominant players who own the network, you have to be involved in, and you have to pony up and do your part and suck off the right person in order to get access to it. And then you got to have the liquidity. You got to have the enormous amount of capital necessary to even start participating in this field, in this zone of play. Think about all that in comparison to using the Lightning Network. You immediately have access to everybody on the network. You can operate at a tiny scale. I am operating as part of that network. I facilitate payments on the Lightning Network for people, and I don't even know who it's for. I can go to my node, I can look, and you're like, oh, well, shit, I routed 15 payments today. That's interesting. I don't even manage my shit very well. It's just kind of up there for the sake of me using it. I could manage it very specific, like very purposefully, and do much, much better actually trying to maintain a strong position on the network. And the barrier is no bigger. The barrier is just me devoting my attention to it. And I can do this at a tiny scale or a big scale, and there's no barrier. My risk management is node management. My risk management is just knowing how to hold my keys and run a piece of hardware. It's no different than running any sort of like mobile position or anything on the internet. It's not a custodial risk. It's not none of it is a liability. And if you want proof, you know, even people who spread the FUD that Lightning Network is fractional reserve and Lightning Network is leveraged and it's just promises and IOUs, you know how the easiest way to just prove, just kind of naturally know that that's not the case, is what happens to the Lightning Network when the price of Bitcoin crashes 40%? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Think about it. That's how you know it's not fractional reserve. That's how you know this isn't some leveraged system. This is how you know you're actually moving actual Bitcoin, because the network does not give a crap what the price is. It's not collateralized that you don't have to worry about whether your TUSD is still on peg or not, and then you have to wipe out a whole, you have to liquidate a whole bunch of trades or a whole bunch of positions, which means your stable coins go. It's not DeFi. DeFi implodes. These things completely blow up because you know it's rehypothecated, because you know it's some collateralized bullshit that's using another token that's backed by some central institution that just bought a bunch of damn Bitcoin, and when the Bitcoin price falls by 30%, the whole fucking thing just starts to collapse. Lightning doesn't budge. Lightning doesn't move. I don't even have to go look at my channels. I know everything is working exactly as it is because we're moving actual Bitcoin. We're settling the actual SAT asset, and it's irrelevant whether Bitcoin price is $60,000 or $30,000. It does the same shit. In the terms of a payment network that can instantly settle, is not leveraged, is not some DeFi collateralized garbage, and that operates no matter what the price of Bitcoin is doing, and that you have the liquidity on either end in the market as the network continues to grow, as the financial markets on either side of it continue to grow, and the ability to onboard and offload Bitcoin extremely quickly with massive amounts of liquidity and massive volume, suddenly that is able to move dollars better than any other payment system on the planet. And that is what we are beginning to realize. That is what the infrastructure players, that is what the major financial markets, that's what Western Union is beginning to realize. That is what Strike knows. That is what NYDIG knows. And that is what they are building right now. They know this is happening, and it will not be stopped. You cannot reconstruct those walls in a permissionless open standard where everyone speaks the same language. And as soon as they move over to it, it doesn't matter what code they are using on their end. It doesn't matter what their API is. If they are plugging into the Lightning Network, they are on an open network that loses those permissioned, those walls. It is no longer a walled garden. They no longer can keep the small competitors out. They are no longer able to maintain their competition only with huge players who already have the licenses and already have massive liquidity. They have to compete with every single node on the network with a damn channel. And in that fiat global payment system, in those fiat cross-border settlements, quote, these fees add up with each intermediary that is used, and they average out to around $25 to $35 of fees per $200 transaction. The smaller and more secluded the jurisdiction is, the more expensive the payment is. This is going to be entirely flipped on its head. The fact that you are a small, secluded jurisdiction is not going to add to your costs at all. In fact, it may very well be that because essentially the airwaves are open and that liquidity is so easy to allocate, that you might actually have the benefit of less fees because you're not constantly having to reallocate liquidity in order to fill the payments going through. But that's hard to say. Regardless, you're not going to have that outsized disadvantage because you're a small jurisdiction. And this is also why small jurisdictions that are getting screwed and that have to live on 30% of their GDP being remittances or 50% of their GDP being remittances are exactly where the adoption of Bitcoin is going to happen first. We're going to see, and I've talked about this a couple times on the show, Jameson Lopp had a really great tweet about this like a year ago or something like that. El Salvador is a perfect example of what makes sense for one of the first countries to adopt it. And it's also going to be that this adoption happens slower. It's going to be piece by piece by piece by piece. But as they start to interoperate, as they start to get on a joint standard, we're going to see small country by small country by small country that is being left out or utterly screwed by the system as it is, join an alternative system that works better, that works faster, that works cheaper, and can send dollars better than the SWIFT system can for the Western modern world. And eventually they are not going to have a choice but to get on the train as it continues, as it is leaving the freaking station. But because of that, you're not going to get enormous, we're not going to be talking about $1 trillion jumping on it tomorrow. We're going to see it in a couple of billion dollars here and a couple billion there from countries that are then allocating, you know, that sort of a amount being put into the infrastructure and to be switching these things over. And then, you know, maybe only a small percentage of the country's payments starting to go through it as everything's being tested out and experimented with. But we're opening the door to a flood that is ready to happen. So while it's only 2-3%, 5% of the scope of what's possible, starting to get interested, starting to use it, wondering what it is, testing it out, does it actually work? Can I really send $10 to El Salvador for free? You know, like, and as they begin to realize this and they begin to adopt it, then liquidity goes up, and then you start to see open the door. You get another 2% in, you know, Nigeria, you get another 2% in the Central African Republic, you get another 2% in Panama, and then all of that starts to work together. And suddenly there's just kind of this alternative system that you can just use, and it just freaking works, and it's just cheap, and it's fast as shit. And that 2% in all those countries becomes 3%, becomes 4%, and then the move starts to happen, and it's real foundational network growth. It's real infrastructure growth, and the ease with which all of these tools, they're building tools for Bitcoin. They're building tools for Lightning. So these things get open sourced, and then you get some project like, you know, Bitcoin for Countries and Strike and what NYDIG is doing and what Galloway Money is doing. And it becomes so easy, like, and Block with LDK, you know, Jack Dorsey even said in, I believe it was the sit down he had with Michael Saylor, if I'm not mistaken, he was talking about when they hired the developers and they did the grants for the developers, they didn't tell them what to build. He literally just said, build what you think Bitcoin needs. And that could be, you know, all of you building completely different projects, everybody working together, whatever it is. Just build. You're free to choose what you think is valuable. And they ended up working together and they built the LDK, which is a development kit for Lightning to make it easy to onboard, to use, and to make business infrastructure for Lightning payments and for integrating with the Lightning network. And they actually ended up using it at Cash App, that they are using the LDK in order to implement Lightning, which they now have and which I use. I have withdrawn from Cash App over Lightning and it freaking works. They were not intending to do this. They were not explicitly trying to build something for themselves, but the developers themselves were trying to solve a problem in the industry. They did, and it turned out to be one of the best solutions. As these things get built out, as all these companies start working together and they're building on the same standard, all of this stuff is interoperable. Anybody can now use LDK and put their business on the Lightning network as well. That $25 to $35 fee on a $200 transaction is going to start disappearing. And it doesn't even matter if people know that Lightning network is the reason. It doesn't. For the same reason your grandma didn't need to know that her analog phone was now speaking over the internet, and her long distance went away, and now she can call her friend in California, or she could have a friend in California, because it doesn't cost her $45 to make a phone call over there. It's just going to happen. If it doesn't die, it must happen, because it is actually settling real value. It's not a liability. It doesn't have the interoperability problem. It doesn't have the high cost. It doesn't have this huge economies of scale problem of needing so much liquidity, of needing financial licenses to be a part of the network. Anybody can be a part of the network. And now with something like Taro, where you can issue fiat tokens, where a bank can issue a dollar coin, a dollar token, and use the Lightning network as liquidity and send that dollar so that you're not even having to you're never even having to speak the banking industry's language. You literally are speaking, you're using Bitcoin dollars and the Lightning network. You're using dollars on Bitcoin and liquidity in the Lightning network to send dollars anywhere else in the world. And you're back to banknotes. Like I've talked about numerous times, you're back to banknotes on a Bitcoin system. You're Bitcoinizing the dollar itself. All of that liquidity is going to move through that. It is going to happen. I don't know how long it's going to take to happen. It'll be a mess in the meantime. I don't have the slightest damn clue what the price is going to happen, what the price is going to be like tomorrow. But I want you to listen to a quote. And this is just after that $200 transaction quote. In 2022, 96% of the estimated $156 trillion in cross-border payments will be done between banks using the CBN explained above. $156 trillion worth of payments, worth of cross-border payments, were done on that CBN network. What kind of liquidity and market cap does the Lightning Network and Bitcoin need in order to facilitate $156 trillion worth of payments? If your average fee on $156 trillion cross-border payment is the more conservative that he gave at 6%, that's just shy of $10 trillion in fees. And that's with MTOs. That's with money, the money transfer operators, the Western Unions, the TransferWise, the MoneyGram, the potential fees for Swift messaging and for cross-border payments through CBN is near 10%. But I'm just using the 6% just for the sake of making it as conservative as possible. 6% is nearly $10 trillion in fees. If that infrastructure, if that back end went over to Bitcoin and Lightning Network, we're talking about the potential of cutting that, of dividing that by 50, about returning that amount of value to the world in not having the friction of the liabilities, of the jurisdictions, of the licensing, of the walled gardens, of the lack of interoperability, of the only being able to trade promises that you cannot guarantee anything of. It could save $10 trillion by using it as the base infrastructure and liquidity for moving dollars. The Bitcoin market cap right now is like $500 billion. Guys, don't sweat about the price. We're changing the f***ing world. All right, that'll do it. I've ranted long enough and I've got... I have got to get on a show in like 5 minutes. So let's close this out. Thank you guys so much for listening. Huge thank you to Sam Callahan for this piece. Really got me amped up. Swan Bitcoin always for... so much great writing, for being just such an awesome Bitcoiner company. Corey has, you know, called out the Terra USD shit, and he's also called out that Corey is the CEO, by the way, and he's also called out the stock to flow. Like, he is right there to even smash the bullish narratives that he thinks are nonsense, because he knows it makes us look bad and stupid for, you know, embracing them or leaning on them as if they're... just because they're bullish, they must be right. Just, you know, major shout out to Swan. They're always killing it. And, you know, like I said, this is when you get Bitcoin off of exchanges. Set your auto withdrawal at Swan Bitcoin. Get yourself a BitBox. Get your Bitcoin behind your keys. Get that shit safe. You don't know what happens in these kind of crazy times. Protect yourself and stack like mad. With that, thank you guys so much for listening. I am Guy Swan. This is Bitcoin Audible. And until next time, everybody, take it easy, guys. You have been listening to Bitcoin Audible, a 111 production.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.